You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, as Sweden ends a decade-long arms deal with Saudi Arabia, we ask what happens when defence meets human rights. Plus, we assess the latest from Russia and Ukraine as the US announces fresh sanctions on Ukrainian rebels in an effort to end the ongoing conflict. Also ahead...
Looking back, it would have been better for me to use two separate phones and two email accounts. I thought using one device would be simpler, and obviously it hasn't worked out that way.
Yesterday, Hillary Clinton, for the first time, addressed the controversy around her private email. Is it a mere security issue, or will it actually have an impact on her presidential campaign? Plus, like a particularly bad perma-tanned horror movie villain, Silvio Berlusconi may be about to rise from the dead once again. That's all coming up here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. It's just gone 1800 hours here in London, 1401 in New York City. Before we kick off today's discussion, let's have a look at some of the other main headlines. Iraqi forces have retaken a large part of the city of Tikrit from ISIS militants. Soldiers and Shia militiamen now control two-thirds of the city. In the US, a search is underway for seven Marines and four soldiers after their army helicopter came down while training in Florida. And Morocco has recalled its ambassador from Nigeria after accusing the authorities there of using King Mohammed VI in an election campaign by saying he had spoken by phone to Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan. Should never, never do that. Joining me now in the studio is Mary Dajewski, Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist for The Independent, and Sebastian Borger, London's correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Sebastian and Mary, welcome to you both.
Hello.
Let's begin with Sweden, where a diplomatic row with Saudi Arabia appears to be growing. Yesterday, Sweden confirmed the end of a decade-long arms agreement with Saudi Arabia after the Saudis blocked Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström from speaking about human rights at an Arab leaders' summit. And in the latest update on this story, Saudi Arabia has now announced it's recalling its ambassador from Stockholm due to Sweden's remarks over human rights and democracy. Sebastian, I look at this story and I feel rather happy that, you know, that a liberal democracy has said, you know what, we could sell lots of arms, but, you know, if we can't talk about human rights and democracy with our friends in Saudi Arabia, then so be it.
It ties in, doesn't it, into the long-standing discussion in Sweden about the fact that this neutral country has for decades been one of the main arms exporters worldwide. And I think there's been unease about that for a long time. It doesn't come across as terribly strategic the way it's been announced. It sounds slightly like sour grapes, doesn't it? You don't let our foreign minister speak, therefore we cancel a deal which has been going on for 10 years. I mean, I suppose I would have expected that to become a topic for conversation when the new government took over, the Social Democratic government. But it is fascinating. I was on a panel about, this is only a slight distraction, about the influence of Saudi money and Saudi ideology in Germany and the problems that causes for the integration of Muslims in Germany. And a liberal Muslim was arguing very cogently, I thought, by allying ourselves with Saudi Arabia and constantly selling arms, which of course Britain does and Germany does as well, we are maintaining a very, very poisonous influence on Islam worldwide.
Mary, call me naive, perhaps, but I've always found it difficult, this idea of nations that called themselves democracies and had certain beliefs in human rights, selling weapons to countries that really didn't. It always just struck me as like, just don't sell weapons to bad people. I mean, it perhaps a naive attitude, but you can understand why people think that.
No, I think there is a degree of naivete there, because you do sort of think that if making weapons and hardware is what you're good at, and Sweden is rather good at it, as indeed the British are rather good at it too, that it's something where you go out and you look for markets and you sell. But I'm sure there are going to be, just to be extremely parochial, I'm sure there are going to be very many people in Britain who are going to look across with envious eyes at Sweden and say, how come, is this the advantage of being a small country that can uphold certain principles? Whereas if you're a bigger country like Britain, where you aspire maybe to play a bigger part on the world stage, you have to say, you feel that you sacrifice certain principles. You cannot imagine the British government turning around and saying, because, say, a government minister, a female minister also, it has to be said, was not going to be asked to speak in public in Saudi Arabia, that we would cancel any sort of contract with Saudi Arabia.
The British government lowers the flag when the Saudi king dies over Westminster Abbey, of all places.
And there was a huge fuss about that. I mean, I remember walking down Whitehall and wondering why on earth the flags were at half-mast, because there didn't seem to be any reason for it. And then we were told, well, when a foreign monarch dies, this is to do with having a monarchy rather than having to do with a special relationship with Saudi. but you do rather ask questions about it.
Just to turn back to Sweden for a moment, Sebastian. It's, you know, as Mary says, maybe, you know, Sweden can decide, we're a small country, we can do this. But I've seen Sweden's former foreign minister Carl Bildt today has been saying, well, look, actually, you know, we're losing jobs at Ericsson. You know, we can't afford to lose jobs in our defence industry as well. There is going to be, you know, an argument within Sweden that, look, this is all very well, us standing up and saying we don't like this, but there are people in this country who rely on this for jobs.
As Mary was pointing out, that's the reality of the situation. And in that sense, it is particularly interesting that it's a social democrat government, which traditionally, at least, has been allied with the unions in Sweden as anywhere else. So I expect, that's why I'm saying it comes across as slightly sort of a policy made on the hoof.
I want to ask you about this. In fact, Mary, maybe you can answer this one. It's, you know, it would be one thing if the new Social Democratic government had come into power and said, right, we are reviewing all sales of arms to dictatorships. And if we feel that this doesn't follow our principles, then we will, you know, we'll revoke all these deals. And then this, which is a bit like, well, you know, we tried to talk about human rights, they wouldn't let us, so therefore, you know, tough.
Yes, I mean, this has a certain sort of aspect of knee-jerk petulance about it. But on the other hand, what it could do is open up a debate in Sweden of the sort that other countries would really, really like to have about the merits of making and selling arms and the things that you sacrifice in order to do that. And the jobs issue would obviously come into that. But I think if you were going to have a public debate about it, you know, this is something that I think Britain could do with one of those debates too.
Yeah, but genuinely, I think within the European Union, you know, you'd have a lot more clout in worldwide if you came, possibly could agree on a position together where you at least find some criteria when you want to sell arms and when not. Maybe that's utopian as well.
We're going to come on in just a moment to talk about Russia. But before we do, Mary, the argument that supporters of the arms industry often use, or one of the arguments often use, is, well, look, if we don't do it, someone else will. And if Sweden in this situation doesn't want to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, someone like Russia might want to. And that's then going to, you know, create jobs and send a lot of money that we don't want to go to Russia there. Do you think that, you know, that countries like Russia, for example, are going to be looking at this and thinking, well, look, you know, if you're going to have your principles, that's fine by us because we'll jump in?
I'm not sure how successful Russia would be or has been at selling arms to Saudi. Saudi has generally preferred or been encouraged to buy weapons from the British and the Americans, and indeed, as we see, the Swedes. So I'm not sure that that is so. I mean, I have this image, maybe completely unjustified in my mind, that even as the Swedes take their decision, the British are booking planes to go to Saudi to sell their own arms. So yes, I'm sure there'll be other salespeople trying to take the place, but I'm not sure that it'll be Russians.
Okay. Now, just a couple of hours ago, the United States announced fresh sanctions on Ukrainian separatists, including the former Prime Minister of Ukraine, Mykola Azarov. The sanctions also included the Russian National Commercial Bank, which recently moved to Crimea after the annexation, and the Eurasian Youth Union, which has been accused of recruiting people to fight in Ukraine. All this while just hours earlier, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called for help to reinforce a ceasefire, as it has emerged that Russia is still arming and training rebel forces in eastern Ukraine. Sebastian Borger, it's all very well the Americans doing this, but in about 3 or 4 months' time, the Europeans are going to be looking at renewing their sanctions. And it's not entirely clear if all 28 member states are going to say yes.
Well, first of all, I find it very interesting that the Americans should announce new sanctions. It doesn't bode well, really, for cooperation amongst the Western allies. I mean, it's Germany and France that have taken the lead role in trying to negotiate that ceasefire, more or less backed up by the European Union. And it looks slightly as if the Americans are trying to throw a spanner into the works. The fact that Russia is an unreliable negotiating partner, and that we should remain extremely vigilant of both actions and intentions of Mr. Putin, is by the by, I would have thought. But it comes across very awkwardly, to my mind.
Mary Dzhevsky, it seems somewhat ad hoc, this sanctions announcement. In fact, many of the sanctions announcements, it doesn't seem as if there is a clear path of, well, you didn't do this, so we'll impose these sanctions. We're warning you, if you don't do this within a month, say, we'll impose these. Is this just like, oh, well, we need a few more names. Oh, this person, they'll do. Oh, yeah, let's sanction them. It comes across like that sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I find the timing of this new round of sanctions really completely extraordinary, because I'm not quite sure what message it's supposed to send. We know that the early sanctions were designed to discourage and to punish Russia for annexing Crimea. We know that subsequent rounds of sanctions were designed to discourage Russia from interfering any further than it was deemed already to have interfered in eastern Ukraine. We now have, for the last 4 weeks, we've got something akin to a ceasefire in the east. What message is Russia and the separatists to take from this if their best efforts to keep this ceasefire going and to have it observed, then the response comes from America that another, I don't know, 18 people or whatever, get slapped sanctions on? I mean, it simply doesn't make sense if your intention in imposing sanctions is, as they say, quote, to change Russia's behaviour.
Although, you know, I understand what you're saying, they're saying akin to a ceasefire. But, you know, we've heard Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO chief, today saying, well, look, actually, we still believe that Russia is supplying the rebels in Ukraine with weapons, with all sorts of things which are helping them fight. So,
yes, but the point is that they're not actually fighting at the moment. That both sides acknowledge that the hardware that was stipulated in the ceasefire agreement has actually been withdrawn the requisite distance from the front line. And it seems to me that by imposing further sanctions, you're actually sending a completely contrary, a perverse message that really doesn't encourage people to enforce or to abide by the ceasefire, even insofar as it's been enforced. I also have some doubts in my mind about the veracity always of what NATO says. There've been NATO spokespeople, including people at the very top, who've made very incautious and unsubstantiated statements about what's been going on in eastern Ukraine. And I think we have to be very careful at taking at face value even what somebody with the authority as the head of NATO says.
Sebastian Borger, you mentioned earlier about how Germany and France were leading the diplomatic efforts, at least publicly anyway. It's been obvious since the beginning of this that the US, or certainly certain aspects of the US administration, people within US politics, have wanted to be far more hawkish with Russia. How do you think that Germany and France are going to... Do you think they'll see these sanctions as being, well, this helps, this is sort of helps buffer up our position, or are they going to be privately a little bit annoyed?
We haven't heard from either government yet, have we?
No.
So we can't... we can only guess. It does come across. You've got to have the suspicion that it's a signal by the Americans, who have been extremely skeptical of the ceasefire with reasons that I can very well understand, not a problem. But on the other hand, you think, well, this is the only show in town. You haven't offered anything. You can't seem to offer anything. So give it a little more time, at least. You know, that there's at least this ceasefire, as opposed to the one in the autumn of last year, had some sort of roadmap for future steps to get away from conflict. And I would have thought, you know, another 2 or 3 months wouldn't hurt us, but. We'll I don't say. Know. Was it Putin's confession that he had actually been in Crimea after all? That it was Russian troops, not some funny
little green men,
exactly, volunteers, or was it the Nemtsov murder? We're not being told, and that's not good diplomacy. I wouldn't have thought.
Okay, Sebastian Borger and Mary Tchaikovsky, thank you very much. Just for now, when we come back, we'll be discussing three politicians in order of popularity: Angela Merkel, Hillary Clinton, and way, way down the list, Silvio Berlusconi. Stay tuned.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, still with me, Sebastian Borger and Mary Tchaikovsky. Now, Angela Merkel's visit to Japan has been marked by her comments about making sure they talk about the war in order to reconcile with neighbouring nations, both China and South Korea, she was talking about there. But while she continues on her visit to Japan, back in Europe, Greek politicians have been equally insistent that certain aspects of the Second World War are worth discussing again. Earlier today, the Greek Justice Minister Nikos Paraskevopoulos suggested the possibility of seizing German assets in the country to compensate for the Nazi occupation of Greece. Sebastian, I'll begin with you. Greece has a certain point here, doesn't it? That, you know, there was a loan that they were forced to take that they shouldn't have to pay back.
I'm in the lucky position not to have a house in Greece, so that's a good start. I think, yes, you know, I've studied and we were at school in the 70s and 80s, we were taught a hell of a lot about the Second World War and the Holocaust and the Germany's guilt and all that. There wasn't very much talk of Greece, to be honest. I have just recently learned, before Mr. Tsipras came to power, I hasten to add, a lot about the terrible atrocities that were committed there. And I believe, compared to other nations who Germany invaded, that Greece hasn't had a terribly good deal. I mean, there have been compensation payments. And unfortunately, I think even the new Greek elites will admit that a lot of that money has gone into the pockets of people who it shouldn't have gone to. So that's, I suppose, a problem of international law. But I could envisage a discussion about that. Again, I mean, it's maybe a topic today that these policy announcements are made on the hoof where you think, for heaven's sake, a serious discussion like that by threatening to take away German assets in Greece.
But it's about, isn't it, Mary, that the fact this is within a context, you know, of a broader discussion about Germany and Greece right now. And it's partly about Greece saying, look, we are not just, you know, we are not the only ones, you know, arguably at fault for what's happening here right now.
I think it came as a shock to quite a lot of us with the first round, say, about a year ago of the Greek-German tensions, where it was so clear that the Germans were on one side, as it were, leading the fiscal austerity party, and the Greeks were completely on the other side. And you were seeing these posters of Merkel dubbed out as Hitler in the streets of Athens. And you just thought, how close are we actually to history that we thought had been banished a long way? Those tensions come to the surface so quickly. The other thing I think is very interesting is Merkel going to Japan and talking about how, you know, you've got to learn to deal with the past, which of course she can do doubly from moral high ground, but both because Germany is seen to have handled the Second World War reasonably well, and secondly because Merkel, having grown up in East Germany, is less tainted than many West Germans would feel, because the East Germans didn't have the economic miracle, they didn't have the very showy prosperity that so defined post-war West Germany. But I think that outside places like Japan and Germany, you know, in Britain and America, really, we don't understand what it is like to deal with a military defeat, a comprehensive military defeat. And I think the British in particular are very, very bad at understanding what happens after a country is defeated.
I want to come back to something you said earlier, Sebastian, about, you know, you not knowing about what Germany had done in Greece. I found this a lot when I was a correspondent in Africa, and almost every country I went to, there would be a story there about something that either Britain or France or Belgium or Germany had done. Now, not all of those countries was I aware of, you know, exactly, you know, okay, the Mau Mau in Kenya, fine, but there were things in Ghana that Britain had done that I didn't know about, that every Ghanaian you spoke to knew absolutely everything about. And there is, isn't there, this thing with a lot of countries where if something has been done to you, you remember it and it's part of your history. But if you are the oppressor, often, you know, we're not taught about every single thing that's happened.
Well, if I may say that, it might be slightly incautious, but I have two teenage sons at school here in London. I believe that their education about the British Empire is entirely lacking, lacking. All the good things of it, as well as all these atrocities, they haven't got a clue. And I, what I'm saying is, what we were concentrating on in my school days, which are long ago, obviously, were focused on Soviet Russia, were focused on the Holocaust, were focused on France, Belgium, etc., and Greece, and the Southern Front was much less of an issue. That's, I think there is a slight difference, to be honest, to the complete ignorance that I perceive here in Britain about the atrocities during the years of the Empire.
Mary, do you think that's right? Not just about Britain, but maybe, you know, you mentioned America before, not knowing what it's like to lose. But do you think also, a country like America, and you can look at France as well, or Belgium, the atrocities that these countries have committed in the past are often not taught in schools now?
I think that this may be starting to change in Britain, because it became a rather controversial issue with the last Secretary for Education, Michael Gove, because he basically said that it was a disgrace that these things weren't taught, and he wasn't talking
about
the...
But he was arguing that the Empire was a good thing.
Exactly. And so he was saying, yes, it was a disgrace that this whole chapter of British history didn't appear on the school curriculum. And he said that, in future it would have to. But then you have really the reason why it's probably been avoided for the best part of 50 years, which is talking about the Empire and about colonialism. It's going to be very difficult to do it without taking one side or the other. And so I think the curriculum is being very carefully looked at to consider how to deal with that, to deal with the atrocities, and to deal with maybe some of the better sides of colonialism.
We've got about 3 minutes left, so I want to quickly just talk about Hillary and Silvio Berlusconi, not together. Oh no, Hillary's emails, Sebastian. I didn't care about this story until I saw this press conference yesterday, where she was pretty awful, and it made me think, God, hang on, is there something actually here?
I've been told that it seems to be normality in US politics for people to use their private email accounts. I find it outrageous, absolutely outrageous. You take a public office, you must have a clear border between your private communications and what you do as a government person.
No,
the same happens here
agree.
In Britain with the education secretary that Mary already mentioned.
Yes,
it's
absolutely
outrageous.
What seems so extraordinary about this is that, to my mind, having lived in America for 5 years, Americans are very formalistic about these things. They're more formalistic than Europeans, which is why it's such a surprise to me that it should have arisen with Hillary. And it's not going to threaten her campaign, but it's just one of these things that's going to gnaw away at it.
Do you think it won't threaten the campaign? It was funny just watching it. I thought, I think it could threaten it for two reasons. One is that it plays into the whole idea of, the Clintons, they're a bit shady. Are they hiding things? Mm. And then the other thing I think it highlighted for me yesterday was, God, she's not very good at this.
No, now, I think absolutely. I think there's two things. One of them that I was trying to say is that it adds it to the sort of cumulative effect of all the other things that hang over Hillary in particular and the Clintons in general. But I also think that Hillary has never actually been terribly good at the sort of presenting herself in and dealing with difficult subjects. She found it extraordinarily difficult to deal with the murder of the US ambassador in Libya, where there was a question of culpability of the State Department, at least a degree of negligence. She avoided that, then she prevaricated. It did not reflect well on her. She finds that very difficult to deal with.
And just finally, Silvio Berlusconi, I really can't believe that he may actually be able to come back. Sebastian, you were saying before we went on air that Silvio Berlusconi is actually quite popular in Italy.
You said he was unpopular.
Well,
and
no,
there must be. Look, 30, 35, I think at one stage, 40% of Italians voted for him.
I know,
There must be a residual popularity there. The good thing from our point of view is that the left now seems to be much better led under Matteo Renzi than it had been for the 15 years that Berlusconi was on the stage.
Mary, you've got about 10 seconds.
Don't you think that Italian politics, European politics, has been missing something without Berlusconi.
Oh, God,
so
no.
having Berlusconi not in power, but as a sort of comic elder statesman, that seems to me to be absolutely perfect.
OK, well, on that dubious note, we'll end it. Mary Dajewski and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by David Pleasant and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. Marcus Hippie will be here in just a moment with some music. The Entrepreneurs is after that, and I am back at the same time tomorrow with more Midori House. Thanks for listening.